Change.
We need to change things up.
It's a show about change.
Welcome to Bob's Basement. Here's your host, Bob Willette.
Welcome to Bob's Basement. And joining me in my basement virtually today is a Gemini Award winning, Emmy nominated writer, comedian, and former employee of mine, Paul Bellini. Paul, how are you?
I'm good, Bob. How are you doing, boss?
Yeah, there was a short time there. You were working with me at Proud FM. It was a really terrific time.
You know, one of my secret ambitions has always been to be a radio DJ. I always loved radio. It was something that I took to very early on in life, like when I was 6 or 7 years old. And so the idea of being a voice on the radio always really excited me. And when I heard about Proud FM, I thought, finally, maybe there's a chance. And I looked at who they hired. I thought, oh, there's definitely a chance. So I nosed my way in. And I remember the first time we approached you, it was Howard Kane and I.
That's right.
To do thing with show tunes. And we're expecting that there's going to be a budget and stuff. And it's Proud FM, of course.
Yeah, you're not the only one to walk away from Proud FM going, I'm wondering if there was a budget. And there never was, unfortunately. Well, you know what?
Remember, it started off, we got paid a little bit.
And then they wanted you to do it for free.
I know. It became volunteer work for the last few months.
I know. You know what? I could write a book on my almost 10 years there. And I made some, you know, we made some great radio. We did some really, really fun and interesting things on a shoestring budget and had some really, you know, I mean, we won Canadian Marketing Awards and Canadian Music Week Awards. We did some pretty cool things. You know, unfortunately, the signal wasn't great. And, you know, go ahead. Sorry.
That was always the issue was the signal strength because now everybody listens to everything on a computer. So everything's streaming, blah, blah, blah. But back then, if you didn't have a car to listen to it on, you couldn't pick it up on your radio.
You couldn't pick it up in the village at all. No, exactly. Exactly. So let me, you know, I was just explaining to you the kind of the concept of the podcast that we talk about change. I wonder, maybe we'll start here a little bit different. Let's talk about the village a little bit. I want to like, and how it's changed. And are you a resident of the village? Like you used to live down, or did you live down there when you were working with us?
I first moved to this neighborhood in the early 80s. And then I kind of jumped around the city, but I came back in the mid 90s and I've been here ever since.
Right, right.
You know, downtown is convenient. What can I say?
Sure. The village seemed to be, even when I started at Proud FM in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, or I guess 2007, I guess, the village seemed even more important then, but less important than it would have been in 97 and maybe even 87. You know, I feel like as the community became more and more accepted around Toronto, the village became less and less important. Would you agree with that or?
Well, I think one thing that happened was the complete erosion of gay media. You know, we used to have Pink Triangle Press publishing Extra every 2 weeks. We used to have Pride Vision, which was gay cable television. At one point, we had Proud FM. And all those things are basically kind of gone or at least have dissipated in some fashion. So that was always really sad because gay media, I thought, really amalgamated us. Also, there were more bars and bathhouses in the old days. A lot of them have closed, and it's a smaller market, even though there's probably a bigger community.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we could go into the technology conversation, and people don't have to go to bars anymore to hook up and meet people, and you know, so you know, there's not as a big a need for bars. But yeah, I loved working there. I loved being in the village. It always had such a great vibrancy, and you know, it always just felt so great. Not just around Pride, but in general, it was always so much fun. I miss going down there.
I will say, I don't think it's completely devalued or ruined. I think there's still a lot of fun happening. You know, during the quarantine in the summer, they would put out tables and chairs on the street. They took a car lane of traffic and used it as patios. It was great. I thought, why not do this every summer? Like they, like in Montreal type style.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it really brought people out. And once again, you had that flush of community that was so exciting. So that's my recommendation.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. And you know what? The Cafe TO program is continuing. They are, people are applying for it. Hopefully they do the same. Pedestrianize it. I think you're right. It's wonderful there.
That's great.
Let's talk a little bit about you coming to Toronto. You did a movie about being the second most famous person from Timmins. Is that right? Is that what it's, was that the premise of the movie?
I'm sure now I'm about fourth or fifth on the list. I keep going down.
So you're born and raised in Timmins?
Born and raised in Timmins. And Timmins is 440 miles north of Toronto. So it is a little remote. The next closest city is Sudbury, which is also a nothing city. So when you're in Timmins growing up, you are so cut off from the world at large. We didn't get cable TV until 1972, I think. And all of a sudden we went from having, you know, two CBC stations, one of which was French language, to having cable. So we could see what the rest of the world was doing. That was an exciting bit of progress. And it made me want to leave home.
Were you in high school at that time? Were you been there, elementary school? Like you're
just starting high school.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I actually engineered an escape.
Oh, did you? Here's a big change in your life. Escaping Timmins.
Well, you kind of had to, you know, there was a lot of internal pressure, like from families.
Right.
Stay in Timmins. You know, why don't you become a teacher and teach in the high school? That wouldn't have been a bad life. I'm not knocking it, but I had ambitions. And I, you know, my mother used to buy movie magazines like Rona Barrett's Hollywood, and I'd read them and think, this is where I need to be. So even as a little chubby kid, I was very high-minded and very eager to achieve something. So in high school, I decided to make high school my laboratory and try and figure out what I was good at, art, writing, acting, whatever. I tried everything. Ultimately, let's be honest, I'm really only a writer who dips his toe in everything else. So, but I realized if I got a scholarship to a university in Toronto, that there would be no excuse. I would definitely be going to Toronto. And that's where I wanted to be, in Canada's biggest city.
Wow. And it worked out. You ended up at York, right? York University.
I went to York University to study film.
Okay.
I went to film production, and I realized I had no aptitude to handle cameras or light meters or recording equipment.
Right.
So I switched to film studies, and I got A's and A pluses. I was really good at that. I still am.
I'm like kind of flabbergasted to think of a 14-year-old kid going, you know what? I'm going to find myself. I'm going to take that time. That's very self-aware for at such a young age.
Well, the gay thing was very big because, you know, I knew from a very young age that I was gay, and I thought, how's that going to work in Timmins? In the 70s, it's a small repressed community. I need to go to a big city where I can be more anonymous. And there's a bigger selection, a bigger pool of talent to choose from. So, definitely my ambition was you have to leave a small town if you don't feel comfortable in it. And as a gay man, I could never feel comfortable. I'm not sure, maybe now, but Timmins is a different city. I visited it last summer, and it's not where I grew up anymore. It feels different.
I mean, that's, you know, remarkably mature and obviously very formative, but, you know, to know, you know, people's journeys with their sexualities are all different, and people realize things at different points in their lives. And you hear stories. I have a good friend of mine who worked at Proud with us. And when he came out to his mom was like, oh, honey, I know. I've known for years. You know, I knew when you wanted a vacuum cleaner when you were 4 years old, you know, like it was his joke that he told. But if you're not sure and you're in a small town, like you almost fear for your safety sometimes, don't you?
No, that wasn't it.
No,
it
okay.
Was more about that I felt like I was better than everybody else. I'm a horrible, arrogant person. But also, I longed for gay community. I wanted to be surrounded by like-minded people. And I did have gay friends in Timmins growing up, but we were all deeply closeted and no one would talk about it.
You didn't know that you were.
Well, we all kind of knew, but no one said anything because, right, you know, it's a horrible thing in the 70s. And then AIDS comes along and made it a lot more difficult. But by then I was in Toronto, so I could handle it better, I guess.
The AIDS epidemic in Toronto, New York City, Toronto, San Francisco, you know, all kinds of major urban centers.
Imagine though having AIDS in Timmins, what a nightmare that would have been.
You wouldn't be able to go for help anywhere, probably, right? Like, I don't even know.
I think there would have been a lot of misunderstanding.
Yeah, for sure.
To be honest.
When did writing become your thing? When did you know you were going to be a writer? After, you know, you said you were going to try to figure out in high school, what spurned that on to know that you could write?
Ooh, maybe I was in about grade 4 or 5, and the teacher asked us to write a composition, 2 or 3 pages, about a legend or a myth, that the start of a myth, like why do storks deliver babies or something like that.
Sure.
And I wrote one called Why People Vomit. And the teacher was both horrified and impressed because it was a really stupid story, but the choice of subject matter was so unlike everybody else in the class that she knew that she had a weirdo in the room. And she actually made me stand up and read it aloud. And here's how I knew I'm a comedian. I couldn't stop laughing at my own jokes. So even at that tender young age, I'm thinking, I'm killing here.
Oh, man. I have a daughter who is a burgeoning, she wants to be an actor. And it's amazing to watch the, before the fears of being a teenager get in there. And, you know, the bravado of a single digit age child is amazing. It's so, and then to see you doing that, writing that story and reading that story. Were there, you talked about 1972 when cable came. Were there shows that made you go, this is what I want to do at a certain point? Or,
well, I think Mary Tyler Moore's show and Maude were very influential in that they showed modern women. And I thought, okay, well, if they can do it, I could do it. Because there was no gay role models. And I liked the Dean Martin show because he was always drunk. And I thought, this man's life is a party. Isn't that what we all deserve? So, but it was more pop music, really, than
TV. Oh, really?
It was popular music that really made me want to do something creative. You know, you hear something like, I remember Superstition by Stevie Wonder was one of those songs that I could listen to 1,000 times and still do. And it always seems fresh. And it's like, how do you do something that great? How do you achieve that?
Is music part of your process?
Like, well, it is now because of Mouth Congress. And it bears explaining. I'm not a musician. I can't write or read music. I can't play any instrument. I can barely sing, but I've had a band for 35 years.
Right.
And we're always trying to come up with new ideas and record new songs. So for me, it's very much of an exploration of a creative process. Not so much wanting to write a hit, but to create something really interesting.
So but does that music that Mouth Congress does, because it's I don't want to say experimental sound, but would that be accurate?
yeah, because here's the thing, it's mostly Scott Thompson and myself,
right?
And we have a core group of musicians who seem to get us, who understand our process and who are willing to play along. And they're very creative, and they're all straight kids, right? And they know that for us, what has to be achieved is something in the lyrics that makes a statement, and that the music has to support that lyrical statement. So, but we also like to do instrumentals sometimes. I mean,
but you don't play any instruments.
Well, I don't play any instruments. I just hit the record button, or maybe hit the beatbox button.
I do want to get to your relationship with Scott Thompson and the kids in the hall, but I also want to know, like, where, like, when we talk about change, was there a moment in your life where you knew and you've kind of alluded to this already because of your confidence, but you knew that I'm going to be able to work for a living as a writer.
I still haven't had that. obviously being hired on the Kids in the Hall show as a writer was remarkable validation because right. Prior to that, I was their assistant.
What were you writing at that time? If you don't mind me asking, sorry to interrupt, but like what did you do to write at that, like to get your name out there? Were you writing like short films or what were you doing?
I was basically, you see, here's the whole thing. I went to university with my best friend, Randall Finnerty. He was from Timmins. He went into visual arts and I went into film. We lived in a residence and I met Scott Thompson very early on. And right. He was insane. And I was drawn to his insanity. He used to wear underwear to walk around the building. I mean, he just was one of those people who had no filters, right? And he was very creative and had a million ideas. And I liked that. And we started making short films together. Whenever I needed an actor, he was there.
Okay.
If I said, I need you to fall out of a tree, he'd climb a tree and fall out. So I thought, here's a guy who really, he doesn't understand no. So that was great. That definitely allowed us to create together. So a lot of my writing is defined around what he and I did. I mean, I was 19 when I met him. So
right.
Most of my creative life has been defined around this other person, which is fine. It's not to say I don't have my own ideas or I do my own writing and stuff. But a lot of what I like to do is stuff that we do together.
Collaborative stuff. I mean, you also wrote on This Hour as 22 Minutes, right?
Yeah, I did 4 years on 22 Minutes.
I'm a huge fan of sketch comedy. I'm an SNL kid. You know, SNL started like the year after I was born. You know, it was like I've all through the good years and the bad years of SNL. I love stand up as well. I have good friends who are yuck comedians and stuff. I'd love to know what, and this is kind of a big broad question, but when you're writing for a show with This Hour has 22 minutes, was that a collaborative process? Were you in a writer's room? Were you alone? How did it work?
22 was a show a week.
Yeah.
So the way the structure was is that everybody gathered Monday morning and would pitch ideas, and we'd come up with like 200 ideas, wow, just throwing everything at the wall. Then you'd spend the next 2 days flipping through newspapers and magazines looking for the facts and trying to find the jokes. On Wednesday, we did a read through with full cast and all the department heads. By Thursday, we were shooting the pre-segments. On Friday night, we were in front of a live audience. So crazy. It literally was a 5-day work week. And then the show would be packaged over the weekend and shown the next Monday night. So even as we're starting the next show, we still hadn't seen the previous week's results.
Right. And I never thought of that.
Yeah, it was fascinating though, because you never had a chance to dwell on either success or failure.
Oh, right.
You just had to keep moving forward. And news happens every day. So our jobs had to happen every day. It was a totally different experience from Kids in the Hall, where we would, you know, talk about a scene for days before putting anything on paper.
You had no choice, right?
22 left you no choice. And also, you know, we had to write jokes. You'd write 30 or 40 each, maybe get one or two in the final episode. So it's a huge overhead. You're creating a lot of material just to get the little bit that you need to fill the time slot.
Were you writing more desk bits, or were you writing sketches there too?
Well, you try to do both. As a writer, you're hired to do everything.
Right.
Create with the cast, to come up with segments that could be pre-filmed, and stuff for the live show, which includes the desk jokes as well as interviews. Like, we used to call our interviews double enders, in that it was like, you know, we'd do the same thing that the CBC would, pretend that somebody's at a remote location,
yes,
answering the questions of the person at the desk, even though they were in the same studio, right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm fascinated with the creative process on a show like that. And you alluded a little bit to the Kids in the Hall. Right now, they were just down in South by Southwest celebrating a whole bunch of stuff. And how long were you with that show for its entire run, or as a writer, or how did that? Well,
I knew the kids in the hall back in the Rivoli days when Scott joined. Right. He was already, you know, we're old friends at that point. And he said, come and see my new comedy troupe, because it was not the first one he was in.
Okay.
And I remember I went that night and thought, this is different. This is special. And I really wanted to get involved, but I'm not an actor. I'm not a performer. So I had to make myself useful somehow, like putting up posters and stuff like that. I started videotaping the shows because my buddy Rob Rowan had a camera. And my archival footage is now in the documentary that was created for Amazon Prime.
Wow.
So it's a good thing that I started shooting all that footage back in the early 80s. It definitely came in handy, you know?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, so anyway, so I just made myself useful. When it came time to do the TV show, they hired me as an assistant. And I really wasn't very good as an assistant. I remember one time, I said to Bruce McCullough, oh, this guy phoned for you. And he looked at the thing and he said, Bellini, there's only 6 numbers. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to write them all down. And it was like, how bad is this person as an assistant? Then in second season, the kids decided to hire a few writers. And I put my name forth. And I said, look, I've been helping Thompson for years, refining those Buddy Cole monologues and stuff. And could I be considered? Everybody liked me. They were used to me. They didn't know if I could deliver, but they hired me anyway. And it was great. It was all of a sudden, you go from 0 to 60. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Writing on this major show. And it was tough. It was trial by fire. And I don't remember a day where I didn't feel insecure.
Right.
You just don't, even when you have a giant success, and there were a couple of those, you never really feel confident. You always think you're going to be fired.
Well, they talk about that's the vibe for SNL. As I mentioned earlier, like basically all the writers are always on edge because they feel like that they could go at any time, right? You know, because if they're not getting anything on the show and whatnot. So it's interesting that would transfer over. I mean, also Lorne Michaels produced I want to go back to, you saw them and you said, these guys are special. And you kind of said, I'm going to attach my train to these guys. Yeah. Like, what was it about it? If you don't like, what was special about what they were doing? What was different?
Well, I remember the first sketch was, it was Mark doing a girl going through a rack of clothes at a thrift shop. And I thought it was so funny. I don't even remember if it's an improv or a scene. And then there was another one they did called The Professor with him and Kevin. And I laughed so hard. And I thought, you rarely see this kind of sketch work that's really character focused. It's not a parody of something. It's very specific exploration of human behavior through characters. And I really liked that. I thought that approach made so much sense to me creatively. And also, like I said, because I hung around with Scott and I often lived in the same house or apartment at that time, I was always aware of what he was doing. And he was going, you know, that Buddy Cole character, because Buddy Cole was something that we improvised in my living room. And I had the video camera, I started taping it. So as he was getting comfortable with being a Kids in the Hall member, we had created this character and he started doing it live and it was quite successful. So he'd consult me on the monologue. He'd go, I'm writing a new buddy monologue. It's 80 pages. Can you help me turn it into a 4-minute monologue?
Yeah.
And, you know, so we'd go through it and I'd say, like, he'd read it to me. And if I laughed, he knew that's the joke to keep.
Right.
So I was all of a sudden a sounding board for this person. And, but I'd come up with suggestions. I go, why don't you put that part here? And, you know, that sort of thing. So my editor's mind really came in handy. But also, you know, I was a witty child. I was the kind of kid that liked to make people laugh, and yeah. I understood comedy innately. So my lack of performance skills maybe got in the way in terms of me being a star on the show. But it didn't prevent me from understanding comedy and what they were trying to do.
But you were, yeah, but you were, yeah. Were you the was there only one Paul Bellini? Was there anybody else like that? Like, did Dave have somebody that he worked with on the side or any like?
Well, yeah, because Mark and Bruce had a comedy troupe out west in Calgary, and the other members were Frank Van Keeken, Gary Campbell, and Norm Hiscock. So all of them came to work on the show as writers.
Oh, okay, okay.
At one point, we brought in Diane Flax because we were aware of her theater work, and she's very funny. At one point, we had Andy Jones from Codco.
Wow.
So there were other writers.
Yeah.
I was mostly there as Scott's writer.
Yeah.
I think Scott was a kind of a demanding, difficult diva. And sometimes the other four didn't want to be distracted. So by giving me a job, they sort of gave him a focus away from them. And like, Paul, you deal with Scott, sort of thing. And it worked out well because obviously you know each other well enough. It's all about chemistry.
Yeah, for sure.
Comedy writing is all about, you have to have good chemistry with the other people in the room or else you're not going to last at the job.
You say you're not a performer or you don't have, but you did perform on the show. You have some, you know, a very iconic cult-like character with the towel bit. Can you tell me how that came to be?
Yeah, they wanted to do a contest on the show, and they were trying to think of a good prize, like dinner and a show with the kids in the hall, or win a new car, or a man arrange. And then Mark said, how about Bellini in a towel? And it was just one of those dumb non sequiturs.
Yeah.
I think I'd been telling Mark a few days earlier about visiting the Romans 2, which was a bathhouse on Bay Street. And he said, what are you doing there? And I said, well, you strip down to naked, except for a towel, and you walk down these long corridors, and there's all these people in different rooms, and you poke your head in and see if you like to be with that guy. And he thought this was the funniest image. So when it came time to create a prize, he suggested that's what I do. And I thought, yeah, okay. And I was a very shy guy. Like, the idea of showing my body on television was mortifying. And I used it as an opportunity to get over that. So I thought, I'm going to do this because if I put it out to the world, maybe I'll lose that shyness. And that sort of happened.
That's amazing. You know, try as opportunities come at you and using it to help you evolve to become, you know, a different person, not a better person, but, you know, being more accepting of your own body. My gosh, like, how great is that?
Well, also, I wanted to be on a TV show and get paid for it. So I did have other purposes.
Sure. But
the other thing was, I knew I could do it. What I was asked to do was something a silent comedian could do. It was really because the whole thing was, Bellini doesn't have a facial expression. And I thought, okay, Buster Keaton.
Right.
So it's about my body being this odd, incongruous element, walking through the background, this bizarre little fat guy wearing nothing but a towel. And when you see his face, it's inscrutable because it doesn't suggest joy or anger or anything or enthusiasm. It's just literally a stone face. So I knew I could do that.
The idea of going out there and doing it and then your friends and family seeing it, like, must have, what did your family think of that whole series of appearances?
Look, by my late 20s, there was no one in my family that didn't know I was a weirdo. So whatever they thought, they just went with it.
Yeah.
You know, the weird thing was, in first year of the show, our Timmins affiliate didn't play Kids in the Hall.
Really?
So I'm on the show and the fucking TV station in Timmins wasn't even showing it on their CBC affiliate. So it didn't even have the impact you would think. It sort of came later.
Well, I would say syndication, right? Did you find...
Well, eventually the affiliate picked up the
right
show.
Yeah, yeah.
People were aware of my involvement. Then there was some newspaper articles in the local paper. And then, of course, Shania comes along about 6 months later. So here I am coasting, thinking, I'm the most famous non-hockey playing person from Timmins. And then Shania Twain comes along and sells 26 million records. It's like being stomped on by a dinosaur. You know, it's like Godzilla trampling on you.
Oh, you're still loved. You're still a favorite son of Timmons, I'm sure.
I don't think so. But poor Shania, they tore down her museum.
Did they? I don't even know that. No.
Well, they built this whole museum and nobody was going to it. And then they discovered that there was actually a payload for like gold underneath. So they thought, we'll tear it down and open a new mine.
Oh my God. That's so funny. That's hilarious. What happens when you are, a successful, you're a writer, you're a performer, and then the show ends? Pardon me? Employment. Yeah. Like you had said, you always felt like you're, as a writer, you're always thinking, on 22 minutes, you're going to get fired because you're not getting enough on the show. What happens when the show actually ends? How does that work for a writer? How does that make you feel?
This is what happens in Canada, is that it doesn't matter how successful your show is. There aren't other shows for you to go to.
Is that still true?
Well, watch TV in Canada. I mean, there's lots of TV shows, but they're like 6 episodes that come and go. It's hard to build any kind of momentum in this country. The ratings are always small. There's no publicity machine. There's no star system. There really isn't.
No, there isn't. So you're right.
When your show comes to an end, it's almost like your career comes to an end. What happened to me is, so I left writing sketch on Kids in 22. You'd think, what great credentials. And all that was available to me was like animation at Nelvana, some crappy award shows like the Genie Awards, cooking shows, children's stuff. I mean, that's what you go to. You leave this great comedy career and you end up writing a cooking show. And that's the best your agent can do for you. So it's really frustrating. And I'm always telling my students this because I teach sketch writing at Humber. You know, always prepare for the worst because it's almost inevitable in this country. Some people go to LA and find success. That's great. But a lot of times you go to LA and you're just stuck in development deals, or you end up being a waiter and hoping for an audition. And honestly, careers, it is like buying a lottery ticket and then buying another one and expecting to win and then buying a third one. it's really a tough thing to sustain, quite honestly.
Well, I'm trying to think where I want to go here. I got a couple different ways to go here. I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you about, because you mentioned that you teach sketch writing and, Humber, was it Humber? Did Humber have a comedy like course or like, yeah.
Like, yeah, for over 25 years now.
Yeah, like, I guess my question about that is, you can't, there's the old saying, you can't teach funny, but what can you teach with sketch?
Structure, topic material, content. It's true. You can teach people to write jokes, but funny is an innate thing.
Yeah.
It really isn't like a math problem. There's a magical element to making a joke work. You know how you can be a stand-up, bomb one night and kill the next. Yeah. And it's the same material. So there's a million factors. There's timing, there's tone of voice, there's breath control. But when I teach sketch, first of all, I show them the structure of a sketch, which is a very absolute thing, beginning, middle, and end. Then we look at topic material. We look at how characters function in a sketch, what each character brings to the sketch, twists and turns that are necessary, attitude, all these things are things that you can give people as exercises, and they can discover their comedic ability by doing these exercises.
In our current quote unquote woke state, is it harder to be funnier now?
Comedy students are surprisingly less woke than you think. I mean, they still don't want, they don't want to deal with insensitive material.
Sure.
And obviously my students are all vastly different, very diverse groups.
Yeah.
I could rarely did I ever have a room of just all white guys. In fact, I don't think ever in the entire 12 years I've been doing this. It's great. I think comedy is something innate. It has nothing to do with race or sex or anything. It's about a point of view. Every now and then I'll have a student who pushes the limit and uses a word or a phrase, and I can see the other people in the room getting a little nervous. And I always use it as a teaching moment.
Yeah.
And it always comes down to one thing. Hang on a second.
I'm sorry.
It always comes down to one thing. Do you want your audience to love you or hate you? Because an audience will turn on you like that, right? Certain words, certain ideas just don't fly in the room anymore. And if you're doing your material for an audience, you have to understand and respect that. It's not even about you. It's about them. It's about the audience's perception of the material. So that's always my warning, is you can do whatever you want, but bear in mind that you have a responsibility to other people. That's what comedy is.
That's an interesting tip. Yeah, you have a responsibility to the audience, you mean? Like, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're in an
era where, you know, Chappelle does his stuff about trans, and he's obviously working out a million ideas. And then, you know, on Twitter, there's that quick rush to condemn. And it's like, are you really listening to what he's saying? Or why are you so uncomfortable with what he's saying? Like, I have a million questions with the reaction, not so much with his material. And you know, a lot of times Chappelle will say something about gay men, and I'm thinking, well, that's not even remotely true. But I don't go to Twitter and condemn him, right? But I'm not the type, obviously. I'm an old man in my 60s. I couldn't give a fuck about Twitter.
No.
Or post social media. But you can see where the playing field is getting a little sharper.
Well, I guess that's what I mean when I ask, is it harder to be funny now than it was 20 years ago? Is that it, because you can be ripped apart, you can be canceled so fast now. And I guess that's why, like, is it, and I'm all for people, you know, being completely aware of not offending people and not saying, you know, things that are hurtful. But I just wonder, is it a little bit harder to be funny now?
There's two things in comedy. There's content, which is currently changing.
Right.
What is allowable? You can't just get up there and do, my wife is so lazy, she blah, blah, blah jokes anymore.
Right.
Because there are a lot of women in the audience who are going to go, ew. So you can't really do that anymore. But a comedian creates a circumstance and an attitude. And the comedy exists within that thing. So if the comedian is true to him or herself, the material should still work.
Right.
You know, we don't all have to relate to everything the comedian is saying, but we have to understand where the comedian's coming from, right?
Yeah, like some context, and that's hopefully in the storytelling, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's harder to be funny. I think you just have to be more aware of pitfalls and landmines, because there are a lot more now than there ever were. That's fine.
Do you still enjoy seeing sketch comedy live? Do you watch sketch TV shows on TV? Do you watch SNL? Are you still a fan of all of it?
Absolutely. And I like to know who the major players are and what they're doing. Every now and then you see a sketch that really stands out, and I think, I got to teach that one. So I look for the YouTube.
Oh, cool.
I show it to my students and I go, look what's happening in this sketch. I like to stay current. I like to be in the know. I watch a lot of stand-up. I'll watch a sitcom if it's really happening. You know, it's good to know what's out there.
It's a pretty great era for stand-up right now, thanks to Netflix putting so many out, and HBO's doing theirs still. You know, there's some really, really interesting stand-up, a good breadth of styles of stand-up comedians that are out there, I find. From John Mulaney, I think he's terrific. All of his, he really is, yeah. But then, there's still those guys out there that are pushing – the boundaries, right? You know, again, Chappelle would be one, but I mean, even just, you know, I don't know, guys who work blue, you know.
Boundary pushing is a little bit of a 90s kind of concept. You know, comedians in the 90s, when they used to push boundaries, like, and Scott Thompson, of course, is a perfect example. They were commenting on a culture that was full of repression, that repressed gays and lesbians, or repressed women and repressed people of color. You don't have that now. So the focus has changed. You can't do the same kind of material because it just doesn't apply to what's happening culturally. So stand-ups have had to shift their focus. And it's good, the good ones can do it, obviously.
Yeah, there's so many out there right now that I quite enjoy. I had, I don't know if you know Mike Wilmot, Mike from Yuck Yucks. He's an old friend of mine. So I had him on and we were talking and he plays, you know, he does stand up that's dirty. He's a dirty comic. He says it himself. And, but he says it's still, he said the same thing. It's not harder to be funny now. He goes, cause people know where he's coming from and he does a good job in contextualizing what it is that he's saying and doing.
I think Mike's voice tells you who he is.
That's true.
Even before he gets into material.
He starts when he gets going like this.
In fact, you want him to say certain things with that voice.
It's true. That's true. Paul Bellini, this has been lovely to catch up with you and get your perspective on comedy and learn about your journey. So you're teaching now? Are you writing anywhere right now?
Well, again, Scott Thompson and I have got our band back and writing songs. And we're also, when we do a show, we write a whole show. We create a scenario for the show.
Oh, amazing.
So we do that. You know, sometimes I make little movies
with
my friends. It's been hard because for 2 years, no one's been able to do much performing.
Right.
But yeah, that's about it for the writing. Teaching does take up a lot of my attention.
Sure.
And I do find it creatively fulfilling because by teaching sketch, I'm learning more about it. I'm actually getting better at it the older I am.
I bet you are. Yeah. That's amazing. I taught radio for a little bit and I found the same thing because you were listening a little bit different.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
In terms of change, I think a career in the entertainment business, you constantly have to change. You have to change with the times. And sometimes you have to change what you actually do, you know, shift from writing to acting or something. And why not? It's all good. And if you're bad at it, you don't do it anymore.
like you know, if you're hired as an assistant who only writes down six numbers and a phone number.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Paul. This is really great. I really appreciate your time.
We got to stop making changes.
This has been Bob's Basement. Thanks for listening.
Things change. That's the way it is.
For more information, email Bob at bobwillette@gmail.com. That's Bob Willette, like Gillette, with a W. Follow Bob on Twitter at Bob Willette. Bob's Basement is available where you find your favorite podcasts. Until next time.
Well, that's the way it is.